नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। नमो तस्सा भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा संबुद्धस्स। बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। So, I thought I'd start the evening by saying a few things, sharing a few reflections on faith, sadhana. I mentioned, like yesterday, the five indriyas, five faculties, no, that the Buddha talked about, five faculties to cultivate, as far as the cultivation of the path of to develop our heart, which starts off with sadha. They come in this order: sadha, virya, sati, samadhi, panya. So that's faith, then energy, then mindfulness, then samadhi, collectedness, calm, and panya, wisdom. And they're very nice kind of qualities to reflect upon. They are presented throughout the suttas, if my memory doesn't betray me, in different kind of ways, standard kind of ways. One is in a progressive way, which kind of makes sense. You start off with faith. No, if without faith, you're not gonna get going, isn't it? Applies to the Buddhist path, of course, but to anything, isn't it? We need to. It's even like it's a quality of the heart. No, that's to make us move forward, we need to have some faith that it's actually worth going forward, isn't it? So that's at the start of the path. And then naturally, if we do have faith, we are willing to make an effort. And so then that raises energy, isn't it? Which is the second faculty. And then maybe not quite as obvious, but I think it's presented like that in the suttas. And of course, if you make an effort with energy, yes, actually makes sense. So that's what needed to establish mindfulness, was the third factor. And often actually in the suttas, mindfulness is described as a precursor to samadhi. Once we've established mindfulness and then we have continuous mindfulness, then the mind gets collected, concentrated, becomes calm, or steady focus. And in the gradual path, of course, usually after samadhi often comes wisdom. Be aware, you be warned, it doesn't come automatically from samadhi. But if you cultivate samasamadhi, right samadhi, this mindfulness, and then the mind gets calm, you get a deeper, more purified vision, you start to see things, in a way that you have can develop a deeper understanding of things. That's a progressive way of talking about those five qualities. There are other ways of looking at it, which also, I think, appear in the suttas. If they don't, they should. It's certainly an interesting way of looking at those things. This is how those qualities balance each other. Faith needs to be balanced by wisdom, no? And we realize that if you have a lot of faith, that's good. It gives us a lot of energy. But if you don't have any discernment around our faith, then that might take us actually in the wrong direction. We can have faith in stupid things, and raise a lot of energy, and but that is, it's like driving a Ferrari in the wrong direction. You can create a lot of harm, of course. You might say also the other way around. So that's perhaps less. That's where maybe it limps a little bit. If you say, wisdom needs to be balanced by faith, it's just to say that maybe wisdom without the heart quality, faith stands for the heart quality, isn't it? Sometimes always we also say wisdom and compassion, isn't it? Then it can be a bit arid, a bit dry, no? But I would say in the proper way of talking about wisdom, we probably wouldn't call that wisdom then if it doesn't have that, it's not wisdom. Wisdom is usually we understand that as a developed quality, which is more than just intellectual discernment, of course. But you could, use that as this. So the heart quality and the insight, maybe intellectual quality combined. Then, in the same way, the other pair is energy and samadhi, and that's pretty straightforward. And you'll see that in the suttas, and you'll know that from your own experience. If you've got a lot of energy, but no samadhi, you're just going to be all over the place. You're going to be restless. It means you've got energy, but it's not contained. it needs to be balanced by samadhi. If you have samadhi and energy, well, that's going to get you places, because then your energy is focused and you can go deeper. And the same the other way around. If you've got samadhi but not enough energy, you're just going to go to sleep. It's calm, fair enough. And that's what many people experience. You know, after you've done a lot of effort, and a few people acknowledge with some smiles, you finally, and you really want the mind to go calm, finally it works, and mind does go calm, but it just goes dull, and you have fuzzy, and you're not quite sure what actually happened, except that it was calm. That's not sama samadhi. No, classically we speak about, for sama samadhi, there needs to be mindfulness. It means, you know, you have to be present, you have to know what's going on. But for that to happen, it means there has to be enough energy. Many teachers talk about that specific, it's something to attend to. If you really go down the path of samadhi, that's often where it fails. If there's not enough energy there at the beginning, then the mind, by it's getting calm, it loses focus, and it just starts to park somewhere. So that's something to attend to. It's an interesting way of looking also at our meditation experience, of evaluating our meditation experience, you know, whether those qualities are there in the right balance, or which way we are out of balance. Too much energy without calm, or too much calm without energy, meaning sleepiness. And also that gives you an indication which direction you need to invest in your practice, which direction to make an effort. And that takes us, of course, to the fifth quality, no, which is sati, which doesn't have an opposite. Sati doesn't need to be balanced. You can never have too much mindfulness. Rather, mindfulness is what watches over those other qualities and allows you to assess, you know, which way you are out of balance, you know, and so that where to invest. So that's kind of the overseer of, if you see it like a balance, it's what's in the middle, isn't it? What the other qualities balance across. But today, let's start to talk a little bit about faith. When I thought about faith, I was reminded about a meeting with Brother David Steindl Rust, who is actually Austrian, an Austrian Benedictine monk, who I think his home monastery is actually in California, I think, who once visited us in New Zealand when I was staying at the monastery in New Zealand near Wellington. And we had a lovely conversation, very lovely man. He is by now, I think, probably an octogenarian, we'll say, you know, at least 80 years old, I think. If you're interested, Brother David Steindl Rust, there's a TED talk with Brother David Steindl Rust about this project that he runs about gratitude. Mm-hmm. It's a very beautiful talk. It's not that often that you have monks. He's got his, he wears his robe and everything, you know, on a TED talk. It's very nice. So anyway, one of the ideas that I remember from him, where he distinguishes between faith and belief, because it was in the context of interreligious dialogue. You know, Brother David is very much into interreligious dialogue. Actually, the Benedictines had, I think, the official permission, I think, from the Vatican, particularly to have the dialogue with Buddhists, and a lot of Benedictine monks actually make good use of that. And so we often have encounters, particularly with Benedictine monks, more than others. And he certainly is very sympathetic to Buddhism, Buddhist ideas. And so this discussion in that context of belief is of course important, because often maybe, you know, some Western lay Buddhists, at least, I can't hide very much with my robe, but I know there's sometimes this hesitation of defining yourself as a Buddhist. You know, because of this perception, if I declare, you know, myself an adherent of a particular kind of belief, you know, I believe in this or that, then that divides us, isn't it? You know, if I believe in Buddhism and you believe in Jesus or whatever, then it divides us, and we have maybe for good reasons, we have difficulties with that, or kind of, you know, because there's enough division already in the world. And it's sad if religion, and it does, of course, unfortunately, as religion in its fundamentalist version, and anything that goes in the fundamentalist tendencies or direction, of course, does contribute to these divisions. But he was saying that those people who have faith, who have truly have faith, they don't need to hold on tightly to beliefs. It's if you don't have much faith, that's when you hold on to beliefs. Now that caught my interest, and you think, well, what does he mean? So about making this distinction. So I think it's worth unpacking that a bit. I think what he's talking about is that, well, you could say like beliefs, as usually a belief in some kind of ideas, you know, whether it's political ideas, religious ideas, or ideas about, you know, other people or daily life things. And so they are basically in the mind, they're in the head, isn't it? Ideas that we hold on to. So that's really something on that level. It's one way of talking about it, of course. You can always define your concepts in different ways, but that's like mainly kind of a head thing, where we believe in ideas. Where on faith, it's a much more fundamental quality of the heart. It's about this basic trust that it is going to be okay, whatever it is. No, even on the ultimate, on an ultimate level, that life, reality, weird as it seems, and threatening as it often seems, is at some level, that's kind of the spiritual faith in the end, isn't it? That it's somehow it's okay. There's a level of depth which I can reach through insight, on which I will realize that it is actually okay, because that's the place where the heart then really can find peace. So that's the ultimate faith, like in our tradition, about like the Buddha's realization, that the Buddha's realization is actually genuine, it's authentic. So it means there is actually this possibility of being at peace with this bewildering fact of being here and not really knowing, not having a clue what it's really all about, no? Or however that manifests for you. That certainly was what, you know, a driving force that got me into a spiritual inquiry. What is all this? What am I supposed to do with my life? What is really worthwhile? No, those deeper questions that drive us. But even on a very ordinary day-to-day level, that's why I'm saying it's like it's a natural, like earlier today we were talking about kindness being a natural quality of the heart. So this faith is also a natural quality of the heart, which serves us in our daily life for anything, even to, you know, get out of bed. You need to have a certain kind of faith, isn't it? That it's worthwhile getting out of bed. I remember sometime when I was, you know, student in Berlin, that sometimes I think I was lacking that faith. It's difficult actually even to remember that, even like that emotional state. But this kind of waking up in the morning and just despairing about another day and just this feeling it's just not worth it, you know? And that's very paralyzing. Mm-hmm. I got out of it in some way or another, so. but I do still remember that. So like with anything that we do, that requires faith. You know, it's this faith that we can step forward, that it's okay to move on. And with all kinds of ordinary things, because actually, intellectually, or not just intellectually, we do know that life is dangerous, isn't it? All kinds of things could happen all the time. And in fact, some things we know, they are gonna happen. We all are going to die, you know? And we can't know that any one of us could drop any moment, you know, just looking at the screen and then suddenly, whoops, what happened to so-and-so, you know? Could happen, you know? And the Buddha even recommended to recollect that, you know, the uncertainty of life. And that's maybe also an aspect of how wisdom, you know, or this insight, like in this case of uncertainty, needs to be balanced by faith. You know, I started off by talking about that. That could be one example is saying, well, we recollect the radical uncertainty of life. You never know what's going to happen next. If you don't have faith, then that makes life impossible, isn't it? We're not going to dare doing anything. We're just too scared. You know, we'd be paralyzed. So on the one hand, we know we could all die any moment. We could have a heart attack, we could have a stroke. Quite a few people that I knew actually died very suddenly recently. So it's all around us. But at the same time, we have faith. No, we have a natural faith. We don't have to kind of make it up. We don't have to kind of contemplate that. We have faith that, well, it's very unlikely that's going to happen, you know, today or during this retreat. So we step forward with confidence for the time being. We're still here. And the most likely is that we're still going to be around for a while. And so then on the other side, we have the wise reflection that, well, we are not sure, then in the balance, if those two things come together, this wisdom or discernment and the faith, then it means we really value the opportunity that we have by the fact that indeed we are still here, we are alive, we are conscious, and that we try to make the most of it. No? And that is exactly what the Buddha was talking about. This is the gist about, you know, really making an effort, taking this serious, you know, try to not waste your time because you don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So this plays out in ordinary things all the time. I just recently, from one of my teachers, I read the, you might think, silly example about, like, so if you sit down on a chair, you know, we sit down on a chair, we don't know whether the chair is going to hold. Chairs can break. Chairs do break. You know, you don't know that when you sit down on the chair, it might just, you know, a leg might go and you fall on the floor and hit your head. But usually we don't check, we sit down because we have faith that usually the chair does what it's supposed to be doing, you know? So that's interesting. That's faith as a very basic quality. Mm. Now that's also, I think, illustrates from daily life what Brother David meant with this relationship between faith and belief. If you don't have faith, what happens in daily life? You start to become, you might develop, in the extreme case, you might develop OCD, isn't it? Obsessive compulsive disorder, you know? Or be very superstitious. Those are in the same range. What do I mean by this? It's like for example, the example with the chair, you might, if you don't have faith, no, then there's just this fear, this chair might not hold you. And you might get, in an extreme case, obsessed about it. You might develop the obsession of checking every chair all the time before you sit down. You're first going to have to check the chair, you know, that is actually all right. No? That's probably a fairly unusual type of OCD. But there are all kinds of different things where people can move down kind of a rabbit hole of these kind of increasing obsessions because of lack of faith in that it's going to be all right. So that means that if I don't have faith, I have to make sure that I'm going to be all right. In order to make sure to be all right, I don't have to do things in a particular kind of way. And if I don't do that, then something bad is going to happen. You know, I think, if I'm not a trained psychologist, but I think that is one of the characteristics or one of the, you know, the possible key element of what leads to obsessive compulsion or some form or another. You know, if I don't wash my hands every 20 minutes, I'm gonna die of some contagious disease. Or if I don't do things in my house according to a certain kind of ritual, then, you know, I don't know, when I leave my house, something bad is gonna happen. Somebody's gonna break in, or so I'm gonna have to check, you know, every window that everything is closed before I leave. And when I finish, I'm not sure anymore, but then I have to start again. And this can become, you know, vicious circles of obsession. In an extreme case, that really make us dysfunctional. You know? But you can see that in less, you know, less extreme forms, it's something that also manifests in all kinds of rituals that we develop, often with a like superstitious kind of background, you know, which is informed by this lack of faith, which is a certain kind, means anxiety, worry, fear. So we're going to have to do things in a certain way in order for it to be right. If not, things might go wrong. And we have that in religion, isn't it? In spiritual practice. And I've got three Thai ladies here that can confirm or contradict me. Of course, I haven't grown up in Thailand, and I don't want to misrepresent things. But of course, as you all know, like in Thailand, Buddhism has been around for a long time, so cultural practices have developed that we might have grown up with from when we were very small. So we learn things, how you need to do things. And they have to be done in a certain kind of way. If not, it's wrong and something bad might happen. Now we can look around that as well, how we develop this these beliefs, which is again this opposition. There's a belief that something has to be in a certain kind of way because there's a lack of faith, you know, that things are gonna be all right, which is, I think, what really the Buddha was talking about, who wasn't into religious rituals, but into cultivating the heart, cultivating faith, cultivating the mind. And you say then, and then you see the emphasis of the Buddha was on the intention. You're saying the important thing is the intention. If the intention is in the right place, means we move in the right direction with the right kind of energy, that's going to be all right. Then the external form is very much secondary. You don't have to then obsess always around getting everything perfect, getting everything right. It's interesting because recently I listened to some Vinaya presentations by an Indian monk from our tradition who had grown up in a Brahmin family, so was very familiar with all the Brahmanic rituals and the Brahmanic aspect of Hindu religion. And he's very, was quite able, of course, to see how much of Brahmanism is actually present in Thai culture, of course, in Thai Buddhism. But also he was comparing from his point of view, from his experience, also from his lived experience, because he trained with Brahmanic priests before. And his understanding and practice of Buddhism, these kind of differences, like where in a Brahmanic ritual, and interesting enough, many of them I practice in Thailand, isn't it? Like around royalty, for example, you know, the enthroning of the king and all this is very much taken straight from Brahmanic rituals. The important thing is that you do everything exactly right. That's the essence of a ritualist religion. And also, like if a Brahmin priest does a chant and he makes a mistake, if I remember correctly what my fellow monk said there, then he just has to do it again. Because the ritual is not valid if there's a mistake in it. It has to be done correctly in this correct kind of way in the form. Otherwise, you just do the whole thing again. Now, we do chanting. Of course, we often make mistakes, you know? And I can sometimes notice that even there you see it's not just an external thing about like one religion does it this way, one religion does it another way. Because those are expressions of what is in our psyche, you know? I can notice my own, maybe somewhere, you know, the superstitious part of myself, which might feel awkward about it. I said, particularly if it's something important, or some people come for some important event and they ask for a chant, you know, a blessing chant, you know, maybe to protect their baby or something, and we sometimes do these things. And then I put my heart into it and I really wish the baby well, and I try to do my best to do my chant, and I make a mistake. And some little voice in my career will think, oh God, you messed it up. You know? And then, and so the protection won't be valid. And maybe something bad is going to happen to the child. It's going to be your fault or something. Because luckily I don't believe in that. And that's an interesting aspect in practice general, because we might have a lot of internal voices that tell us things. So the practice of mindfulness, of awareness, you know, the importance of that is that it's not about not having those internal voices, it's but to recognize them. That gives you the freedom of, and you just can notice a tendency, for example, of superstition coming up, but you can counteract it. And you can say, well, okay, I know that voice that's coming from, but I don't have to believe it. So it's interesting to observe us in our own mind. But to come back to Thai rituals, for example, I remember that there are things like, for example, with numbers. Uneven numbers are supposed to be auspicious, I think. Are more auspicious, at least in the spiritual context. So if you've got an auspicious occasion, you invite an uneven number of monks because to do the chanting. Now, it would be a real faux pas, I believe, in Thailand, for many people, if actually you come for a baby blessing and you come with two monks. I don't know, I'm looking at the Thai seers. Somehow our Thai seers might be beyond these kind of things, but that would really not be the thing to be done, because, you know, you come with an even number for a funeral, but not for baby blessing. So, you know, mix up your numbers and there could be consequences. I certainly remember that with incense sticks, I think even in this monastery, or was it in Hanam, where I was before? You know, like, again, in Thailand, the idea to be auspicious, you use uneven numbers. And with incense sticks, probably the most auspicious is three incense sticks, because it's one for the Buddha, one for the Dhamma, one for the Sangha. But incense sticks make smoke, and you know, and three incense stick makes a lot of smoke, and if you're in a closed room, and some of us feel that's not that auspicious actually for one's health, you know, being more pragmatic from a Western context. So often in our monasteries, like here, when we have smaller rooms, we only burn one incense stick. And we have been scolded by Thai, faithful Thai Buddhists are saying, that's wrong. You know, you cannot just in a puja burn just one incense stick. That's wrong, you know. And who knows what's going to happen if you do the puja wrong. It's kind of not valid or whatever, you know. It's just not possible. You can't do that. That's a belief that you have to burn three incense sticks. Otherwise, that's not valid. It's somehow wrong, or maybe something bad might happen. No, faith is a different thing. Faith doesn't tell you that it has to be three. Faith might tell you that it's good to burn incense. I have faith in burning incense. It's going to do something good. But if it's true faith, it doesn't matter whether it's one incense stick or two or three. You know, it's the gesture that counts, what it does. Isn't it? So it's much more, it's much broader kind of feeling. Interesting enough, and the monastery where I lived before in Hanam, we had a lot of Sri Lankan supporters. And Sri Lankans seem to have the faith that not it's about three incense sticks versus one, but the more incense sticks, the better. And that is, if you have been in Sri Lanka, Sri Lanka is a very hot country. And all the monasteries, temples, as they call them there, they tend to be open. They're open spaces. So you can burn loads of incense. And it doesn't matter if it's a really kind of poisonous synthetic stuff, you know, because the stuff just, it smokes, but it goes out, isn't it, into the air, into the environment. But here in the West, our monasteries are closed, and so we've got limited spaces, and in the winter, the windows might close. But believe it or not, frequently in Hanam, where we have a Dhamma hall, is a bit bigger than this, but it's still, you know, it's a limited space. We had kind of Sri Lankans turning up, and they offer dana, and then one of the thing is, they go to the meditation hall to do puja. And so they burn incense. And then, you know, an hour later I come past, and the whole incense dish, it's absolutely chock-a-block. There are not two or three, there are 50 or 100 incense sticks in there burning at the same time. Sometimes so many, they create the heat that the whole thing goes up in flames. But you can just realize it's cultural conditioning. I mean, that's just what they used to do from when they were very small. In Sri Lanka, you come to the temple and, you know, incense, the more the better. But it shows you what a lot of faith can do if it's not balanced by discernment, isn't it? Faith versus discernment then? Specifically then in the Buddhist teaching, we talk about faith generally in having faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, the three refuges. And that is basically about this sense, isn't it, of that there is a possibility for me, you know, that the Buddha's, if you have faith in the Buddha, means that we have faith in the Buddha's awakening. So that what the Buddha was talking about, what made him a teacher, is actually genuine, is authentic. If I have faith in that, then I feel that is somehow relevant to me, that speaks to my personal situation. That's how many of us, and certainly Westerners, come into the Buddhist teaching and develop that interest. And then, of course, yes, faith in the Dhamma means that the Dhamma is, of course, what the Buddha taught, or the truth that the Buddha taught, so that is actually relevant, that is actually really, again, a genuine truth, and that it's relevant for me. And faith in the Sangha, of course, faith that are actually truly there are, and have been, and there are followers of the Buddhist teaching who have benefited from the teaching to the point of awakening to this truth. That's what Sangha stands for in the original kind of Buddhist context. And again, that means, of course, that if there are these followers around, then also it's true what the Buddha said, that this wasn't just good for him, that the Buddha, you know, had this enlightenment and therefore was special, but that it is something that principally any human being make, and that's an important aspect, making the right kind of effort can also arrive at that possibility of true and lasting contentment of peace in the heart, independent of the external circumstances of our life. The faith in that. So again, that brings it back home. So that means this is something that is relevant for me. So it's not just the Buddha. I can practice, and I don't know how far I will go, be able to go, at least in this life, along the way. But if I have faith in the principle, then I know I can benefit from this. But I have to make the effort. So faith in the Buddha Dhamma Sangha then ultimately means also an empowerment of actually developing faith in myself. Because I have to make the effort to actually confirm, you know, through my experience, what the Buddha was talking about. You not just get liberated through a belief. Faith in the Buddha's teaching and the way the Buddha explicitly talked about is just what he called an initial faith. We need an initial faith because we don't know yet. We haven't got the experience of the Buddha, but something in it rings true to us in principle. So we have an initial faith that gets us started on a path in which we can then verify, you know, what say the Buddha or whatever teacher, you know, has taught us through our own experience. And then it becomes confirmed faith. And only when it comes confirmed faith, then it's confirmed by our own experience, then it can actually lead to wisdom, which is ultimately liberating. No? The example that I always use is the one of a map or sat-nav. If I want to travel to whatever, to Sarajevo, and I know roughly where it is, and I get myself a map, but first of all, to go on a journey, I have to have an initial faith. Not that I'm actually going to be able to make it. No, there's some faith in that. And then probably I equip myself wisely with a map or a sat-nav, implying I have to have some faith in that sat-nav that is actually going to do what it's supposed to be doing. But that's just an initial faith. It's not a blind faith, right? So there again, faith needs to be balanced by discernment. No, so I use my sat-nav. But if I use it wisely, there are ways of, you know, there, and we know the examples, we have read them in the newspapers or saw on television about blind faith and a sat-nav. It's, you know, you drive down the road and sat-nav says, turn left, you turn left, you know. and next thing, well, you ran your car into a wall or you're going down into a, not a rabbit hole, but an excavation, because actually the road has been closed for works. You know, the sat-nav didn't know about that, but because you have failed to actually confirm, you know, what the sat-nav is telling you with what is actually your experience, what you're seeing out there. You know, so if you don't have any faith in the sat-nav, you're going to be in trouble because you're always arguing with it. But if you just got blind faith in something, you might end up in a field somewhere. Faith in the Buddhist teaching is always this initial fuel that gets you going. You need some faith, you know, like in daily life to actually get going. But then you use your discernment to actually check, you know, against your experience until it becomes confirmed faith. And so that's very different again from belief, you know, in the way that Brother David is talking about it and why he talked about this contrast. You know, if I have this faith, it's empowering. You know, it's faith ultimately in myself. I trust, you know, that there's a possibility. And then I can trust to go forward. And I also even can trust that it's all right if I make mistakes. You know, because then I feel I can, even if things go wrong, I can learn from it because I trust the principle of practice. If I don't have this trust, then I might feel more inclined to hold on to specific belief, you know, belief in a certain doctrine or rituals, or a teacher giving my authority away because I want somebody else to tell me what to do because I lack the faith, you know, in myself or the trust. So trust, that kind of faith, sadha, understood as trust, like that means a certain ease and capacity to be this uncertainty, to be okay with not knowing, not from, I don't know whether this chair is going to hold me, but I'm going to try. No. When I take the train to Kandersteg, I have a belief that the train is going to go there. That's what I know from the schedule. And I trust that it's going to take me, but I don't know. Things might go wrong. As we know, if you take a train, sometimes you don't arrive where you're supposed to arrive. But I also trust goes beyond that. No, I can also trust, I have a basic trust that even if it doesn't work out, it's somehow going to be all right. I'm going to be able to deal with it. Well, that's how you see how trust, there are layers of it. It goes deeper, no? Until ultimately, an ultimate trust in life that even as, if it doesn't appear like that, you know, things are not necessarily the way they appear. And on an ultimate level, if you trust the Buddha, it is all right. The way it is all right. It might not feel all right, but it is all right. No, that's it, the deepening kind of trust. If I don't have that, I'm going to have to cling to a belief. No? Because if that what I believe in is true, then that protects me from my fear of life. That's going to what's going to make me all right. And that's what I'm going to, that's what's going to make you a fundamentalist. Because that's what going to make everybody who else who doesn't hold your beliefs threatening. Because if what somebody else believes is true, means that what you believe must be wrong. And then it all falls apart, isn't it? Then you're falling back into your basic lack of trust in life. And that's okay. You know? If you've got deep trust, then you don't have to hold on tightly to your belief. No, belief then is more something that's functional. No, Brother David might have some Christian beliefs. I have some Buddhist beliefs. But ultimately, that we know that ultimate reality, because it's reality, is something that's already here. It's something that we are part of, that's part of us. And it's something that unites us on the deepest levels. Even if some of our particular beliefs might at some point turn out to be maybe wrong, we might revise them. But we have a deeper faith that it's still going to be all right. You know, our effort is still not going to be wasted. You're still on a path of developing more understanding, developing more wisdom. You know, no matter which external forms that they are in the end manifest for us. So maybe I stop there. And invite you to make any comments or add questions if you have any.
I hope it works. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, now I have just a small question because you were talking about belief and faith. So I was just wondering about ideologies.
Yeah.
If this also goes under this idea, under beliefs, because I think now or the time we are living in now is like a lot of ideologies that also kind of have this effect of, splitting people apart.
Yes,
so
yeah.
I was thinking about that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think all this, I mean, one could bring lots and lots of examples, isn't it? It has this, it's the same dichotomy, isn't it? Or the same kind of relationship. You say kind of basic faith means trust in that it's okay. Means the more trust, faith understood as trust. So this is all translation for sadha, isn't it? So we can say faith, trust, or confidence. It means I don't have to actually hold on to anything particularly fixed in order to feel okay. I'm fine with uncertainty. I don't need to have fixed beliefs on anything. I can have beliefs, but I don't have to hold onto them tightly. I said, well, this might be true or might not. You know, whatever. I'm okay because I basically trust. It's a very basic quality and attitude of the heart. If I don't have that, I will tend to more hold on to beliefs. And they can manifest on all levels. Of course, they don't have to be religious beliefs. They in religion, of course, they manifest very strongly as fundamentalism. Same as ideologies, political ideologies, because they come out of out of the sense of this basic lack of trust, lack of faith. And then we start to believe in all kinds of things that are happening or not happening. Right into, as I said, the example in our daily life, the most extreme example, like obsessive compulsive disorder. It's to do with this kind of belief. This belief that if I don't do something, you know, in a specific way, at the right time and often enough, or whatever, you know, however it manifests, then something bad is gonna happen. No, it's the same. It can be around any. We can develop it on any kind of thing. No, you can become obsessive compulsive around political ideas, around religious rituals, or around our daily routines. You know, about how the way I brush my teeth. You know, we hold on to fixed belief because they make us feel safe. They make us feel good. You know, if I really believe in what I believe in, it means it explains the world to me. The world becomes a less threatening place. It gives the world some order. It gives me the illusion that I know what's going on. And that gives me the illusion of control, isn't it? So if I've got the right idea, the right ideology, political, religious, whatever, it explains the whole thing. And then even if it's really irrational in some way, it makes me feel a bit more secure, you know, because I'm doesn't have to go as far as just thinking that, okay, that one manifestation of it, I'm among the chosen, so after this, I'm going to be fine and all that. But I think even on a more basic level, it means I've got the map, and it means I've got the overview. I know what's what, you know, how to orient myself. It makes me feel safe. And precisely because of it, then any idea that challenges it becomes very threatening. Now, if you are the opposite type, it means you've got deep faith, then you don't need all that. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses come to your door, and what do? They ask you whether you feel sure about what's going to happen to you after death, and you know what the nature of God and all that. And you say, "Well, no, I have actually no clue." And then they say, "Wow, right? We've got something for you because we know, you know, and we can tell you, so we can save you." And then if you say, "Well, thanks, I'm just quite fine with not knowing. I'm quite happy with not being sure," that really throw them. No, and then you realize what's going on, because the fervor with which they might hold their belief is precisely because the one thing that they find really threatening is uncertainty, not sure. That's a different list, no, but talking about the five hindrances, no. If you can be practiced with doubt and become comfortable with doubt and with uncertainty, that takes you really deep. It gives you a very deep sense of inner peace and, well, it's not certainty, but confidence, because you know you're fine even when you don't know. If you realize that, if it's your experience, you know, it gives a deep sense of confidence, you know, of feeling it's okay. If you don't have that, you're always grasping for something to make you feel okay. Anything.
Mm-hmm. I really like the way you discriminated this kind of basic trust faith in opposition to this concept of belief. So then, and I think that's very helpful. But then a question arises, actually, if someone doesn't have this kind of basic trust or faith, how to cultivate it? And maybe one can cultivate it if we learn to be uncertainty, or what do you think? How can we, because that would be very important then. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that somebody either has that or has it not, according to the personality, but mm-hmm. maybe mm-hmm. one can also cultivate it.
Yes, a very good question. So it might be true that some of us might be from maybe from very early age or from very early conditioning, certainly be predisposed more uh-huh. one way or another on this spectrum, isn't it? You know, how much uh-huh. faith we have or how, you know, or how well we can deal with doubt or not. There are certainly indicators also around that you can see according to personality type. But yes, I do think you can also cultivate. I think it can change, you know, like with anything, but cultivating qualities to change, it might take a long time. But I think you're right on the right, I would think you're on the right track there. I think it's about learning really to be with uncertainty. And that brings us right back to meditation, because that can be a very powerful aspect of a certain approach to meditation. Once you become aware of this quality of awareness itself, to invest in that and to trust that. You know, you remember how Lumpo Samir was always talking about that. But whatever he starts talking about, he always converges on that. You know, ultimately there's that awareness, here and now. It's always here. It's what we really can trust. The more you invest in that, of course, the less you need to invest in the content of your experience. Mm. The less you need to be concerned about everything being the way you need you need it. So the less you need to insist about your preferences being met. The less you need to be worried about always getting it right either, because you know this quality of awareness, which is the true gateway to freedom. Mindfulness is a path to the desert. It's always here already. It's a permanent invitation, as it were, that wherever you are at, whatever your experience is, you can take refuge. Mm-hmm. That has to do with faith. Taking refuge in the Buddha means taking refuge in the capacity to know what is happening right now. And remember, that also means it's not an intellectual knowing. It also means the capacity to just feel how it feels. Mm-hmm. And Lumpo Samedo talks specifically about it like this doubt. You know, that doubt is one thing that we usually find very difficult to be with, because it makes us feel very insecure and we don't know where to go, what to do. So one tendency is always then we go to an authority, an external authority, whether we go back to the books, you know, read it, or to a teacher, whatever, the investor's authority, to get us out of the state of doubt. Now, sometimes it can be the right approach if there's just some information that we need that we don't have access to. But often that's not really what's going to work, because with a lot of the really important, these existential questions, we cannot know, because we never know what's going to happen next. Life is uncertain by nature. So you cannot be certain about life. You can never be certain that the decision that you make is going to be the right one. But how do you know? Because you don't really have the overview, the perspective. No. And so there is where you just need faith. No. So like I remember even specifically Ajahn Sumedho being asked about that, you know, when somebody really had a problem with doubt. Often very rational people are people really stuck in doubt because they try to figure it all out, saying, but they can't come to the place in the heart where they actually know the priorities. So if it's something really important, I really want to get this right, and I'm going to stuck on doubt, what do I do? Now somebody asks Ajahn Sumedho, what, you know, what do you do? Well, just make a decision and hope for the best, you know. Simple, actually it's simple. And then of course you take responsibility, you just work with the consequences. But you just acknowledge for start, you cannot know. So that's not, the more you insist in knowing, the more you're going to be stuck on doubt. So well, how do you learn that? First, you get the idea, no? That's, you know, learning, intellectual learning from studying. Then you apply it in your practice. And meditation is a wonderful place for that. Just this willingness in your meditation to just be with whatever comes up. And then if it's doubt, instead of trying to resolve it somewhere frantically, get me out of here, you just say, well, I'm just going to look at doubt and feel how it is like, you know, is it so bad? No, and just wait and see. That's actually an advice for if you have to make an important question, an important decision in your life, and you don't know what to do. If you've got the luxury to have some time, if you don't have any time, or you're just going to do something anyway, isn't it? But if you have some time, well, just don't do anything. You know, just keep doing what you're doing already. And just stay there, stay honest, stay true to what is your actual experience, which is a doubt. You don't know. You know that you want to know, and you know that you don't know. And that's exactly where you stay put and practice mindfulness. You're aware of that. Because life is going on anyway. No, you can't stop it. And if you don't insist in this moment to kind of solve the problem, when you actually don't know and you're just going around in circles, the proof is that you're not ready to make a decision. Otherwise, you wouldn't be stuck in doubt. So you just wait, you just keep doing what you're doing. Now, it will become clear at some point. No, if you have to make a decision, if you can't continue to do what you're doing, then you will make the decision. And it actually works with small things that I practice with that. I've been stuck on doubt, ridiculous things. And I practice exactly that. You know, if I could decide, well, just just stick to what you're doing. And then suddenly I found myself, I had made a decision. I stopped doing what I was doing, something else. Oh, where does that decision come from? Have I decided to make a decision, to decide, to make a decision, to now decide, to make a decision? It doesn't work that way, isn't it? The decision arises when the circumstances for it are in place, and then you just act. And if it doesn't, then you don't act. And if you think that's really a problem, well, then act. If you think you can't, well, then don't. It doesn't have to be a problem, isn't it? So that's, of course, a very uncomfortable place to be. But if we do practice with that, that's how everything in practice works. It's exactly the same model. You know, initial phase, then comes practice. When you practice it, you're going to start to get the experience. It becomes confirmed phase. And then you realize for yourself, yeah, it works this way. You can be this uncertainty. Mm-hmm. It feels difficult at the beginning. But the more you learn also to be with that unpleasant feeling, you say, well, uncertainty feels unpleasant. But if I don't insist in having pleasure all the time, then maybe that's okay. And that's something we can learn. So that is basically what practice is in general. It's developing the capacity of awareness. It becomes more and more strong, and so more and more able to just embrace anything and any content of our experience. And that is faith. That's faith in its deepest sense. This is one line from T.S. Eliot from the Four Quartets, where he says, love is most nearly itself when here and now ceases to matter. Love is most nearly itself when here and now ceases to matter. I think it's about that, what the Buddha says. T.S. Eliot wasn't a Buddhist, so it's a slightly different cultural context. No, it talks about the true love is when here and now ceases to matter. So like you remember some of the Buddha was talking about, don't invest in the future, don't hold on to the future because the future is not here yet. Don't hold on to the past because the past is already gone. But don't hold on to the present either, because when you hold on to the present, that's where you're attached to the wheel of samsara. That's where the suffering comes from. You know, that's why the Buddha says the freedom of the mind comes when we let go of the present. You know? So even the here and now means the content of my experience doesn't ultimately matter. It means, you know, whether it's pleasant, unpleasant, whether I succeed or whether I fail. All the drama of life on one level, ultimately, you know, where it really counts, it doesn't really matter. What matters is more like how we deal with that, with the here and now, with the content. It's the quality of our heart, the awareness. Well, that's love. No, I think that's my interpretation, what T.S. Eliot was talking about there. When this awareness really comes to the foreground, if that really is your refuge, well, that's love. It means the heart is so abundant, overflowing with love, that it doesn't matter here and now what you're experiencing right now. No, it's like Ajahn Chah once said that in a very brutal kind of way. We were saying, like, actually, from the point of view of wisdom, every kind of experience is of exactly the same value. Exactly the same value. We like the nice experiences. We don't want the unpleasant ones. But from the point of view of insight, you know, the mind is liberated. It's not anymore about the content of experience. That's why the heart is free. That's why the heart is free to express love. That is love. Because there's no fear. There's no fear of anything. Because here now doesn't matter, ultimately.